So as always, it's wonderful to see, to be here in community together. Ma tovu, that's what I feel when I open my eyes and see all of your faces. So this week, we read two Torah portions, Hukat and Balak, in which we leap forward in our journey through the wilderness from year 2 to year 40. Each of these two Torah readings highlights an unexpected reversal in the career path of a prophet, undermining our assumptions about undermining our assumptions and teaching us to be open to whatever is arising in this moment. And the two related stories teach us how our intense emotional reactivity or our focus on pursuing an agenda can keep us from responding skillfully to what's happening in the present moment. The shocking turn of events in Parshat Chukat is God's decree that Moses will not accompany his flock into the Holy Land. So let's look at the context. Miriam, Moses' sister, who saved his life by putting him in a basket in the waters of the Nile as she trusted that he would be cared for by the universe. Miriam, who arranged for him to be nursed by his own mother, even as he was raised by Pharaoh's daughter. Miriam has just died. Upon her death, the community was without water. A pairing of events that contributes to our Midrashic tradition of seeing Miriam as the source of life-giving water. The people joined against Moses and Aaron. Far from offering comfort and evidently unaware of the future tradition of sitting Shiva, of recognizing the exquisite vulnerability of the bereaved, they take out their anger and terror on Moses and Aaron. The people quarreled with Moses, saying, "If only we had perished when our brothers perished at the instance of the Lord. Why did you make us leave Egypt to bring us to this wretched place?" And Moses and Aaron leave the tent of meeting, fall on their faces. The presence of the Lord appeared to them, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "You and your brother Aaron, take the rod, kach et hamateh, and assemble the community before their very eyes, and order the rock to yield its waters. Thus you shall produce water for them from the rock and provide drinking for the congregation and their beasts." Moses took the rod from before the Lord, just as God commanded. And so these are the words in Torah, as God commanded. It sounds like an affirmation that Moses is doing exactly what God commanded. Moses and Aaron assembled the congregation in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, shall we get water for you out of this rock?" And Moses raised his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod. Out came copious water, and the community and their beasts drank. Well, it sounds like everything is working great. The people and the animals have copious water, until the next verse delivers a shocking message. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust me enough to affirm my sanctity in the sight of the Israelite people, therefore you shall not lead this congregation into the land that I have given them." Not given you, but given them. How can we understand this? Needless to say, there are many commentaries. Now, the last time I talked about this parsha, I focused on Moses' difficulty hearing the current instructions because he was under the influence of his memories of all the past times when God said, "Take the rod, kach et hamateh, and strike." God told him to strike the water of the Nile to turn it to blood. And in the exact same situation as this one, when the people had no water right after crossing the sea and escaping from Mitzrayim, God told Moses, take the rod and strike the rock. Moses obeyed, and his obedience was affirmed, reinforced by the flow of water from the rock. From everything that we understand today, through research and cognitive science about how we learn, about how past experience informs the future, about how neurons that fire together wire together, as well as everything we've always known and that our forebears understood about human behavior, all of this tells us that past powerful events inform how we perceive reality and react in the present moment. If you've been strongly rewarded for hitting things with a rod, you're primed to do it again. This alone would be enough to explain why Moses did not hear exactly what was new and different about God's current instruction to speak to the rock before the eyes of the people. On top of that, he's followed God's instructions to bring everyone to the desert, and they've all died, and now his sister and savior has died. So having a clear mind to stay attuned to a subtle difference between past memory and current experience would be even more difficult under these conditions. Our meditation practice is directed at keeping our minds open enough to recognize that reality is not always what we predict it will be. Without all our modern tools of neurobiology, the ancients understood from their quiet observation of their own minds that our conditioning, our prior experience, our expectations, and our hopes drive what we perceive. They keep us from seeing and hearing what is actually happening in the present moment. I opened my Zen calendar yesterday to find a quote from Ram Dass that reflects this teaching. He said, as long as you have certain desires about how it ought to be, you can't see how it is. I'll just say that again. As long as you have certain desires about how it ought to be, you can't see how it is. This is why we have literally double-blind, randomized controlled trials whenever we want to find out what data is available versus what we think ought to be. Aviva Zornberg explains that Maimonides offers a different perspective on Moses' challenge. Maimonides points out that in this instant, unlike many previous instances, God is not angry or frustrated with the people. Unlike other episodes, God is not in this moment reacting angrily. 3 weeks ago in Parsha Baha'alotecha, I described how God reacted to the people's complaints about not having meat by saying, you want meat? Here, I'll give you meat until it's coming out of your nostrils. However, at this moment, God sees an opportunity to demonstrate a miracle of providing life-giving water to thirsty people. God instructs Moses to perform this act before their very eyes, to order the rock to yield its waters, to demonstrate that God, through Moses, has the power to produce water from a rock without the human hand. Maimonides highlights that Moses' transgression was speaking to the people in anger when God was not angry. When he says, listen, you rebels, shall we get water from this rock? He was expressing his own anger instead of channeling God's mercy. Here we see how, as our Buddhist teachers explain, intense feelings cloud our ability to hear and see what is going on in the present moment when our whole beings are hijacked by some intense emotion. Maimonides sees this as the reason for God's decree that Moses will not lead the people into the land, that Moses expressed his own anger rather than demonstrating the mercy of God's loving generosity, and that he could not continue to be a true prophet, accurately representing God. In his book, Overcoming Life's Disappointments, Rabbi Harold Kushner offers us yet another commentary on why God has to deliver this unexpected command that seems so harshly unfair. Kushner interprets Moses striking the rock as a moment of severe burnout, born from exhaustion and the unrelenting pressure of leadership. He notes that it is a sign that Moses, like even the greatest leaders, cannot perform his role forever of being a clear channel for receiving and acting upon what is best for the community. Kushner understands God's reaction as a response to the reality that Moses needs to be replaced at some point by someone who is more ready and more able to lead the community through the next phase of its journey. And so we learn that immediately following the death of Miriam, Moses and Aaron will also die in the wilderness. So the people set out from Kadesh, from the waters of Meribah, where Miriam has been buried, and they arrive at Mount Hor, and Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh says to Moses and Aaron, "Let Aaron be gathered to his kin. He is not to enter the land that I have assigned to the Israelite people because you disobeyed my command about the waters of Meribah." God instructs Moses to take Aaron and his son Eleazar up to Mount Hor, and he commands, "Strip Aaron of his vestments and put them on his son Eleazar. There Aaron shall be gathered unto the dead." And they did as God commanded. What could be a more vivid image of passing on the role of the priest than this description of Aaron walking up the mountain in his priestly robes and his son Eleazar coming down without Aaron, now wearing those same robes, signaling to the people that Aaron has died and Eleazar is assuming the role of priest. Later, we learn when we read Deuteronomy, Devarim, and here's a quote, "The days we spent," as Moses looks back over this, "traveling from Kadesh Barnea until we crossed the Zered Valley were 38 years. By then, that entire generation of fighting men had perished from the camp as the Lord had sworn to them." And we also learn from Rashi's commentaries that between the condemnation of the spies that we read and discussed 2 weeks ago, Shlach Lecha, and this week's story of the community arriving in the wilderness of Zin, that 38 years have passed between the last 2 weeks of reading. During that time, the entire generation that was condemned to die off has died off. And Rashi understands the words of the first line of chapter 20 in this parsha to show that shift. The Israelites arrived, Kol Ha'idat, the entire community, at the wilderness of Zin. And Rashi explains that this indicates the community was now complete, that anyone who needed to perish in the desert from that generation had already died. And the only members of that generation who are left to die are the leaders. Miriam dies at the start of this Torah reading, soon after Aaron and Moses receive their death sentence. Zornberg suggests that it is in recognition of this phase of dying that we're instructed at this point in the mysterious purification ritual of the red cow, the red heifer, Parah Adumah, whose specially prepared ashes are used to purify those who have been in contact with the dead body. And because we have a double Torah reading this week, we also read about the prophet Bilam, whose story is a kind of reversal and upside-down version of this tough passage in Moses' incredible life as a prophet. We've just read about how Moses, the most humble, devoted servant of God, this unwilling leader, he leads only, he tries to get out of being a leader, but God insists. And yet, in his 120th year of life, in a state of grief over his sister's death, he's not able to be a clear channel for God, and he's not allowed to lead the people into the Holy Land. It seems rather unfair. In contrast, Bilam is a prophet for hire. His whole life has not been devoted to God, but he's been up to other sorcery. He's known for his magical blessings and curses. Blessings and curses. Balak, son of King Moab, fears the Israelites will attack his nation and sends his messengers to hire Bilam to curse the Israelites. Now, Bilam insists on waiting until morning, literally needing to sleep on it before deciding. Always a good idea. And in the night, God tells him, you must not curse the people, for they are blessed. So Bilam initially refuses the job, but Balak sends his messengers back. And in the next night of dreaming, God tells him, you can go, but you have to do whatever I command. So in the end, of this well-known story, Bilam ends up opening his mouth and out come blessings for the Israelites. Ma tovu ohalacha Yaakov. So how is it that Moses, the humblest and most devoted of all prophets, is blocked from delivering God's message by his own emotional turmoil, and Bilam, a prophet for hire, opens himself to be a mouth for God's words? In a delightful and comical passage, we learn how Bilam's donkey is the transformative influence in the story. Bilam sets out on the journey with instructions to put a curse on the Israelites, but along the way, the donkey sees a fiery angel of the Lord with a sword blocking the way. The donkey halts. Bilam beats the donkey 3 times, at which point the donkey cannot stay silent any longer, and she says, what have I done to you that you have beaten me these 3 times? And Bilam says to the donkey, you've made a mockery of me. If I had a sword with me, I'd kill you. And the donkey says to Bilam, look, I am the donkey you have been riding all along until this day. Have I been in the habit of doing this to you? And Bilam says, no. And then the Lord uncovers Bilam's eyes. He sees the angel of the Lord with his drawn sword. And the angel tells him, go ahead, but say nothing but what I tell you. So, in addition to being a fanciful and comical tale, the guiding powers of the donkey highlight a very different path to prophecy in this episode from that of Moses. In this episode, Bilam's rational mind is persuaded by the promise of riches to deliver the curse that King Balak hired him to deliver. However, Bilam's animal nature, perhaps representing his intuition, his ability to sense something that is not apparent on the surface of reality, this something stops him in his tracks, and his intuition turns him away from delivering a curse and toward openness to delivering God's intention. Moses, in contrast, is overtaken with emotion in a way that impairs his ability to hear God's message and respond in the present moment. So we're left with the question, how do we know? How do we know when an intuition is important to pay attention to? Or how do we know when we're just being overtaken by some strong feeling? As with many Dharma talks, I leave you with more questions than answers, hopefully in a way that softens some of the constraints that limit our awareness.